Welcome back. Let's start with a brief review. On the board, I have put, again, the definition that I defended as the proper definition of a religious belief. Notice I'm not characterizing religion in general or a religion, but what is a religious belief? And once again, it starts, a belief is a religious belief, and then IFF means if and only if. It's a belief in something as the divine reality that is the origin of all else, where divine means self-existent. Or it's a belief about how the non-divine depends on the divine, or it's a belief about how humans can come to stand in proper relation to the divine. And that's what formal religions are about, helping people to stand in proper relation to the divinity as they think of the divinity. Notice that the last part is also important, that the divine is the self-existent reality, no matter how else it is further characterized. So you have, in Judaism and Christianity and Islam, the divine is God, and God is the transcendent creator and a personal God who enters into his creation and offers human beings redemption. You have in Hinduism and Buddhism that the divine is not a being at all and not personal. It's the beingness that's in everything, and it is the only real thing. All that appears to be non-divine because it comes into being and passes away is the illusory world called Maya, M-A-Y-A. That's the, anything that comes into being and passes away, anything that changes, anything that's limited, anything that can be perceived, that can be conceived, is Maya. So there, the divine is further characterized by not being characterized. There's no characterization you can make. Buddhists would say, we don't characterize the divine at all. That's right. That's why they call the divine nothingness. Not a thing. Not, can't be conceived of as a thing. But far from being literally nothing, it's the only thing that really is, and it's self-existent. And it goes under a number of names I gave those to before. Suchness, Dharmakaya, nothingness, and so on. Many different names in that tradition. So this is the definition that we came up with, and what we're going to be talking about is belief in God in particular in the rest of the course, and how we can know, or what can we know, that God is real, with the emphasis on the word know. Not can we believe it, of course we can believe it. Are we entitled to say that we know it? It's not a belief that is a mere opinion or hope, but a belief that we have are justified in saying we can be certain of. Is that the case? Can we ever be certain? And the answer is going to be yes. We'll explain how. Now, before we leave all that for concentrating just on belief in God and whether belief in God is a justified belief and in what sense and so on, I'd like to trade a little more off of this in order to contrast some of the other ways of thinking about the relation of God to the world, of the divine to the non-divine. And what I'm going to do is use circles. I'm going to use a solid circle to mean the divine reality and a dotted circle to mean the non-divine reality. So the way I would define this, if it was just theism, if it was a diagram that was going to cover Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, then it would look like this. So, the cosmos is non-divine. It depends on God. That's what the arrow means. And the relationship between God and the cosmos is also something God creates. That is, prior to creating the world, God didn't have the property of being the creator of the world, right? But after he created it, he had the property of being the creator of the world, and he stands in that relation. It's a relational property. Now, that characterizes all three theistic religions, but it leaves something to be desired for Christianity, because Christianity has an additional doctrine that Judaism and Islam lack. Jews and Muslims are at one in condemning Christians for this difference, but I think it's the crucial difference that makes Christianity right and sensible in ways that the other two can't match. We'll come to that in a bit. But here's the way I would schematize with the diagrams the Christian idea. And what this shows is that in the incarnation, God takes created things into himself. Now, this is clearest in the doctrine of the incarnation. The doctrine of the incarnation says that Jesus Christ of Nazareth was not only the Messiah promised to the Jews, but the very incarnation of God himself. And Muslims and Jews both object, wait a minute. The main point of our religion is that nothing created is divine. And that's right. But that's not the way Christians explain the incarnation. And I'm going to quote here from some of the writing that's attached to the Athanasian Creed. It is not that in the incarnation our humanity became divine, but that the divine took our humanity into himself. So we are not violating that. This is still a dotted line. It's still Jesus Christ as a human being is still a creature. But God takes Christ into himself in such a way that Jesus Christ becomes the human side of God and God becomes the divine side of Jesus Christ. So we need a different diagram. We need a different schema for it. And by the way, I'm going to argue in another course I'm going to do sometime that that God's having taken into himself created something created is the way God made himself known always. Right from the very beginning of Revelation, God attributes characteristics to himself. He likes this. He's pleased with that. He's angry with this. He talks to people. He makes them promises. He enters into fellowship with them. All those are creation. They're all created things. They're not self-existent. But God has always then taken on characteristics that are self-existent. He's taken on relations that are created. And the relations have characteristics that are created. That's how we can know God. Even saying God is one is still attributing to God a quantity, a uniqueness, however you want to put it. It's still something created. It's a feature of creation. That's a point that I'll come back to much later, but it's based on the Eastern Orthodox theology and on the theology of a few other people, such as John Calvin and Karl Barth. Calvin says about these characteristics, every perfection ascribed to God in Scripture is found in creation and hence is not God per se, but how God relates to us. That's the position I'm going to defend. That's scheme this way. Now let's look at some of the other religions and see how they do it. So I have some housekeeping to do here. Now, these little Venn diagrams are helpful, I think, but they have limitations, too, and I'll point out some of those limitations now. Let's take the view that is called, in philosophy, naturalism. This would look like this. This is the universe. Some part of it is the self-existent part that all the rest depends on. There have been many candidates for that. In ancient Greece, earth, air, fire, water, atoms. Epicurus thought it was atoms. Atoms in space, and they combined to make everything else. Also in ancient Greece, however, there was a dualistic version. There are two divinities, not one. And the one side, the divinity Plato called form, this has to do with logic and mathematics. And all that's rational, that's also self-existent, and the other side is matter, and this side organizes this side. The reason matter isn't just a chaos is that it has order. Wherever it has order, it's subject to some kind of rationality. And human rationality is also a little piece of this. So humans also have this division. This is mind and body, or soul and body, when it comes to a human being. So their view of how the divine related to the non-divine generally throughout the cosmos is concentrated and imitated over again in their doctrine of what human nature is like. A human is a combination of a non-physical, rational mind or soul and a physical body. But this is a naturalist point of view. It's still deifying, making divine some elements that are found in something that's found in the cosmos. Now, as over against naturalism in both its one divinity and two divinity forms, there is also another. And this is a view that has a traditional name that isn't quite exactly right. The traditional name is pantheism, which means everything is God, but that's not quite right. It's everything is divine. And I've been talking about Hinduism and Buddhism, and I'm going to schematize it this way. The non-divine, what appears to be non-divine, the illusory reality of Maya, is contained within, is part of, that is generated by the divine, which is not a person, not a God, not an individual, but being itself. The ineffable divine reality that includes and encompasses everything else. And the reason that this schema is limited is that this solid line should be infinitely big. There's no end to it. The world we live in and experience, the world that we deal with in life and death, that's all illusion. That's to be rejected. So the basic insight of this tradition is that it is in humans, how humans stand in proper relation to the divine is to distance themselves to reject the non-divine. You and I, according to this tradition, are doomed to be reborn into life after life after life of suffering until and unless we come to the insight that all this stuff that goes on isn't real, and the real is the divine, and only it is real, and then we will be delivered of being reborn, and we will be absorbed into the divine. So this is an entirely different view of reality, human nature, human destiny. A guy who has a materialist has an entirely different view. Bertrand Russell said one time, is a materialist, he said, well, I am old and I love life, but I know that when I die, I will rot and that will be the end of me. That's one idea of human destiny and human nature. It's just physical, doesn't matter what we do. Russell has a very eloquent statement of this. All man's greatest accomplishments, the brilliant a noonday sun of the sciences, and all, will all disappear, and it will be the same as if it never existed. That's motivated by his being a materialist. He says, blind to our ambitions and hopes and loves, omnipotent matter rolls on. It's a divinity belief. Not a Christian one, not a Hindu one, but it's a divinity belief. Now, these are samples of different ways of conceiving of the relation of the divine to the non-divine, no matter how the divine is characterized, so that there are all kinds of competing ways of thinking of this, and there are competing ways of thinking of this. Hindus and Buddhists aren't quite exactly the same, and the two of them are closer to one another than to Taoism about how the non-divine depends on the divine. So it's different descriptions of precisely how the divine is further characterized enter into this when you come into concrete positions taken by people, beliefs taken by people. But that is how this gets divided up. I call these dependency arrangements. Remember, part two of our definition was how the non-divine depends on the divine. Here are some schemas that illustrate that. If we played with these circles, we could come up with a lot more schemas. But they don't exist in the world. All the world religions have held only to about three. One of three possibilities. I played around with these circles one day, and you know, it had two distinct divinities and being partly overlapped and not, and all that stuff, and came up with about 14 arrangements. They don't exist. So maybe you want to move to California and start your own religion. You can take one of these schemas that nobody's ever tried, and good luck to you. That's sarcasm. I don't wish anybody good luck taking those, because none of them are the truth, which is probably why nobody's bothered with them. Well, here's our definition. Here are some ideas about how the divine relates to the non-divine. And then we come to the last one, how do humans come to stand in proper relation to the divine? And that's what most of the traditional religions concentrate on. They have all the doctrines and the practices and the holy days, whether it's just meditation and get yourself to the point where you reject the world around you and you are no longer attached to it. It could be that simple, or it could be as elaborate as thinking that the divine entered into our life, came incarnate in a human being, and to redeem the entire cosmos and us along with it. Two utterly different ideas, but you recognize the second one is the Christian one. That's for all of you who are going to be Christian leaders as well as Christians. And for those of you who are not Christians and want to give it a fair shake, we're going to talk about the grounds for believing that. And I did mention last time, and I just remind you of it now, that we are not contrasting faith to reason. It's not the case that if a divinity belief shows up in a scientific theory or in a scientific context or a non-religious context, that it's not a religious belief. It is no matter where it shows up. And it's not that in one case they're taken on reason and the other on faith, because that's not the way the New Testament speaks about faith at all. We'll come to that. And I will repeat something that I said in the earlier sessions. There is not a religion on this planet and never has been. His official writings ask anyone to take it on blind faith. That's an accusation that some people like to make. I won't mention any names, but one's initials are Richard Dawkins. That religion asks you to believe on blind faith, and so it's the opposite of science, which investigates things rationally and gives reasons. That's just not so, folks. And it never has been. What every religion has said is the same thing Christianity says, and Judaism, and Islam, and Hinduism, and Buddhism, and Taoism. All say the same thing. You believe this, you are a genuine believer if and only if you come to see this as true for yourself. You experience it as true, as certain. Now, there are certainly tribal religions that don't have anything that elaborate. They don't have an elaborate theology. They don't say why. They just hand on belief in the gods and so on. But they don't say, take this blindly. They are recommending it on the past experience of their ancestors and the present tribal leaders who experience it as true, so on. And it may be relatively simple. We might even say crude compared to an elaborate Hindu or an elaborate Christian theology. But all the same, nobody in those traditions is saying, just believe this because we say so. Or take it on blind faith. Just for the record, I don't think anybody ever takes any belief on blind faith. We would normally regard that as just stupid. Say, well, here's X, Y, and Z, and you should believe this. Why should I believe that? Oh, no reason. No. We always have a reason, some reason, however attenuated, however poor, we have some reason for just about anything we believe. You believe there's such a place as Bangkok, even if you haven't been there, because a lot of people have been, and there are photographs in encyclopedias and travelogues, and other. You meet other people who say, yeah, I've been there, and It's an interesting place. So that's, do you have a reason? The idea of blind faith is inimical not just to science, but to religion and to common sense. Nobody does it. So that ends this session. I give you time now to think about this, go over your notes, and we'll reconvene and begin to talk, and when we reconvene, about religious experience, what that means, and how that's to be characterized. Types of that. We'll stop there for today.